Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:21 on that Pacific Standard Time. And today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And this has been a week that can only be described as extreme, because there have been extreme moves in just a host of asset classes. But perhaps the most important of those is oil. And the reason for that is because it's by far the most important commodity in the world. There's practically isn't a person alive that isn't affected in one way, shape, or form by the oil price. Whether prices rise or fall, it's either going to take money out of your pocket or put money in your pocket. And then what happens with oil prices really does matter. And it matters to individuals, it matters to consumers, and it matters to banks and countries. So oil prices, the first thing is that there's quite a marked divergence right now between the Brent crude price and WTI. Brent is currently trading around $32.89 and WTI around $29. There was a number of headlines this morning talking about the fact that West Texas Intermediate hit a new 12-year low yesterday, but that certainly wasn't the case for Brent. In fact, both were up not quite 10% in here today, but really not that far off either. And of course, that's only because prices are so low. At $29, you only need a move of $3 to be a 10% move, whereas back when they were $100, $3 was still considered a lot, but it wasn't 10%, that's for sure. So volatility has increased, and there are a lot of shorts in this market, and there's a lot of people still waiting for the second shoe to drop and waiting for an additional decline before we see the lows. And in many respects, it's not nearly as important where the eventual low is for oil prices. My personal view, and I think everybody has got a personal view at this stage, but my personal view is that oil prices are bottoming right now. That this probably is the balance of probabilities is in favor of the fact that Brent crude is currently putting in a higher reaction low. And there is the potential that WTI is going to form a failed downside break in here. But we may see an additional down leg. And I continue to contend that that is less important than where prices eventually top out when a more substantive rally takes place. And that might be at $40, it might be at $50, it might be at $60, it might be at $80, we don't know. And there is the great uncertainty, because we can all prognosticate about exactly what's going to happen with the oil price. I don't think there's many people think that we're going to go back to $100 oil anytime soon. And there are a number of reasons for that. And, that's been our view for a very long time now, that unconventional oil and gas really does represent a game changer for the energy sector. And we've seen the full extent of that over the last year. And there are a number of additional things happening in the energy sector that are likely to put a cap on the ability of prices to rise. And perhaps the most important of those, it isn't on the demand side, because demand generally tends to trend higher over time. And the lower prices are, the more likely it is that demand will trend higher over time. But it's the supply side of the situation. And it is worth considering that hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling are a product of the last big bust in energy prices, because people simply had to innovate or they would cease to exist. And those innovations came from a low price environment. And what nobody is talking about right now is refracking. And refracking means that you might have spent $4 or $5 million drilling an unconventional well, and you can spend a fraction of that going back to that well and refracking it. In other words, setting off additional explosives down the pipe in order to refracture the rock and get oil flowing once more at prolific rates. And that starts to happen at a much lower price point because all of the holes have already been drilled. And then prices only have to rise enough to make it economic, and then that supply will start to feed through once more. So then, yes, there are arguments about the role of solar and how much more efficient solar is getting. And certainly that is true. And it's particularly relevant for the Sun Belt in whatever country one might reside. And the innovation that's happening right now in the nuclear sector, and particularly in with Generation 4 and with reactors, fission reactors, and with fusion reactors, then, you know, when we look out 20 years from now, then there really is going to be just a golden age of energy. But that's not what we're concerned with right now, with prices for oil at these depressed levels. And it really is all about supply. And what is Saudi Arabia going to do? Because there isn't going to be an agreement between OPEC, for example, and Russia without Saudi Arabia participating. And that means that there is, certainly right now, you have Abu Dhabi saying that they're speaking for Saudi Arabia. That might be the case, because Saudi Arabia probably doesn't want to talk with Iran. And they are going to have to sort something out, because Iran has had the sanctions reduced against it, and it is going to be coming back onto the international supply situation. And they're going to be pumping as much as they can. And without some agreement from OPEC, then this beggar thy neighbor environment could persist. And that is the argument on which the bearish prognostications are based. Well, we're just going to have to see. And what we can say for sure is that prices are low, and that there is a lot of marginal supply is looking pressured at these points. And the role that oil plays in so many other asset classes, and it is being looked on right now as a barometer of risk. And interesting that when oil rallies, so do stocks. When oil sells off, so do stocks. It really is a barometer for risk, because short positions are getting closed out, and some of that money then gets moved around by the computer systems into equities, and then vice versa. So the eventual low in oil is likely to represent at least a short to medium term low in stock markets as well. And therefore, it really is worth watching. But also look at the role that oil prices play in the mining sector. In fact, low oil prices have enabled so much marginal supply to continue to exist because energy represents such a large proportion of the total cost of production for these miners. So any kind of substantial rally in oil will knock out that marginal supply, and then the major companies will either have the opportunity to make more money from their own operations, or to sweep in and really acquire attractive assets at bargain basement prices. Well, you know, then miners are heavily leveraged to the energy price as well. And, you know, oil today up 10%, and then you saw these upper dynamics in the major miners like BHP, Rio, Anglo American, and Glencore. And Anglo American, you know, in particular, as a South African miner, has had just incredible difficulties, not least because the price of just about everything that it manufactures has been coming down, from diamonds to coal. And then the South African rand has been trending lower and accelerated to its low late last year. I think the share is down from 1,200 to 200 in just the last 18 months, and it was substantially above 1,200 at the top of the bull market. So then these are really depressed prices for a number of miners, and obviously not without reason, that they have got significant problems. But those problems do start to look a bit better if oil prices rally. And because oil prices have fallen so much, then what we term that as disinflation. You know, prices went up a lot and prices are now coming down a lot. And that is having a profound effect on the ability of consumers to spend. And, you know, we see these really quite positive headlines coming out of the US where people are quitting jobs voluntarily at a record pace, that wage growth is picking up, and that consumer spending is improving. Well, then, you know, it doesn't take, when the Fed sees those kinds of things, that since they have taken so many of the energy and food related items out of their inflation measure, well, they have to look at wages. Wages moves the needle for them. That's why they raised rates last year. And they'll be looking at the resilience of the US economy. Well, the Fed is unlikely to raise rates four times this year. But with those kind of figures, how likely is it that they're going to be cutting rates? And the bond market has been in just been in euphoric state over the last couple of weeks. And the long bond yesterday was at 168. It was up 4 full points. Now, that's a large move in a futures contract for fixed income. It was down almost 2 full points today, and it closed off its high by over 2 points yesterday. So this is an accelerated move, and you know, something that it's perhaps the easiest, most easily identifiable tool from the chart seminar is that acceleration is a trend ending, but it's a trend ending of undetermined duration. It doesn't tell us that this is the ending in big capital letters or an ending, but certainly bond prices have accelerated higher. And to put it in perspective, that and I posted these statistics yesterday, but Swiss government bonds are in negative yields out to 15-year maturities, and German bonds are in negative yields out to 8-year maturities. That means that every single issue that they have out to 8 years in maturity is trading at a negative yield. But you know, you might say, okay, Switzerland is a safe haven, and so is Germany. But Ireland, where it had one of the largest problems during the credit crisis, has got negative yields out to a maturity of 4 years. In other words, people are paying the Irish government to take their money out to 4-year maturities right now. And that's an extreme environment. So, yes, prices have accelerated higher, and we are almost certainly now in a process of mean reversion. And perhaps when we look at the kind of overextensions that we have, then we really do have to ask a question, is that when you see something that has pulled back so violently, then how likely is it that that's going to continue, and how profitable is it going to become progressively more bearish when so much bad news has already been priced in? Well, if oil is a barometer for risk, so is the yen. And is there a good reason why the yen has rallied so impressively over the last 3 weeks? Then it isn't because people have been pouring their money into Japan as a safe haven asset, not least because the Nikkei, which is a substantial global index, is down 30% since November. Well, the reason that the yen has rallied so impressively is because people are unwinding carry trades. The Bank of Japan has engaged in a concerted effort to weaken the yen. And in that process, it moved the yen from 75 to the dollar to just about 125, and that unwound the entire bull market from 2007. Well, that was a substantial devaluation. Everyone knew that they were doing it. You could short the yen, so you could borrow yen, which is the same as shorting it. Then you could take those proceeds and invest them, well, either in the Japanese stock market, or so you'd negate your currency risk, or somewhere you could get a better return, either in terms of yield or capital appreciation. And there was abundant liquidity, so then the size of your positions was very large. But what we've seen is massive deleveraging. Those leveraged trades have not been working out. The people have received margin calls, they've had to close, and the yen has soared. Well, it was at 111.67 this morning, and it's closing out the day at 113.30. And the Nikkei, which was down 4% today, and give or take, down almost 10% this week alone, is up about 3% on the futures. So, you know, this is another very extreme move. And then there is potential here for a reversionary rally. And personally, I'm not participating in it. I would much rather be short bonds than long the Nikkei, for the very simple reason that this has an overhead top formation. So, short term, this has been an accelerated decline, and there is ample potential here for an unwind of this short-term oversold condition. But we have to be cognizant of the fact that there is an overhead top, medium-term top formation, and that, yes, the market is down 30%, and that is a lot, but relative to how much it had gone up previously, it isn't really scratching the surface. So this is still a risky environment, and I would be much happier when I see a higher reaction low. And I see indices starting to push back above their respective 200-day moving averages. To me, that would signal an all clear, whereas right now, this is still a volatile, risky environment. And then so we've looked at oil, and we've looked at bonds, I've looked at the yen, I've looked at the Nikkei. These are incredibly oversold. Well, then you have to look at banks, because on the one hand, yes, banks have lent money directly to commodity-related companies, whether those are energy or miners. And then there has been an incredible amount of paper has been printed by those companies in order to fund all of their expansion programs. And people don't exactly know what banks hold what. So that's one factor that's working against the banking sector. But that doesn't explain why the banking sector has underperformed with such commonality all over the world. Well, another reason is because the Europeans have a negative deposit rate at the discount window. And so now, this week, the Japanese introduced the same thing. And in addition to that, Basel III rules were implemented last year in a lot of countries. And that means that the standard of what banks can hold and is considered Tier 1 capital has been raised. It means they have to hold more bonds or government bonds, and they're inhibited in how much they can lend out and how much leverage they're allowed to have on their balance sheets. And they're now being charged money, and you might just regard it as a tax. They're being taxed by the central bank for holding their assets at the discount window. And then that's a problem, because banks are losing money. And they're unable to lend, so they're not making money. And then we have this issue outstanding with, you know, all this outstanding debt, and exactly who's holding it. And that has really been a factor in why these banks have deteriorated so abruptly. But when you start to look at valuations, and you look at individual companies, and you look at, say, Jamie Dimon today spending his entire annual salary, and that is a substantial salary, on JP Morgan shares, then he sees value. Both Citigroup and Bank of America are trading on single-digit multiples. Well, it would be even better if they had the potential to grow their dividends, and they're unlikely to be able to grow their dividends in an aggressive way because of the burden that they now face from regulations. So then that's a problem, and the Japanese banking sector has crashed lower over the last month. So, and you know, they've been reacting to much the same problem. Well, you know, Deutsche Bank has been in dire straits in Europe. And it is worth considering that right now, Germany only has two listed banks, and then they have Postbank, which is the post office. And every other one of their banks has already been nationalized. And then is there a valid question that might be asked is, does the EU have an interest in the banking sector at all? Would they prefer to just nationalize all of the banks? And that is one of the reasons that prices have fallen so abruptly, because banks are no longer being greeted with a welcoming environment from governments or from regulators, and they're being forced back into a utility type of business model, and that isn't what a lot of investors signed up for. So yes, there are really quite extreme overextensions right now, and companies that have got large asset management wings are probably going to be the ones that benefit most, and JP Morgan certainly fits into that model. Then there is going to be consolidation in the banking sector. And when we look at this over the medium term, one of the reasons that we're in this corrective phase generally for stock markets is because the flow of liquidity has been inhibited by the burden of regulation on the banking sector. And that is now beginning to be seen in the corporate bond sector, where BB bonds, which are the highest rating for junk bonds or high yield bonds, is now back at the 2011 spread high. And it's probably pausing in here today, but it's risen fairly substantially. And because the status quo over the last decade has been that we've had ultra low interest rates, and people have built careers on borrowing very cheap and speculating. And because of the yield-hungry environment that has created for savers, then people have been pushed further and further out the curve. Well, a lot of the money that companies have been able to borrow has been plowed into raising dividends and buying back shares. And spreads over treasuries right now are beginning to break out. And that's an issue, because share buybacks are a wonderful tailwind, particularly at the beginning of bull markets. But the fact that prices rise, and therefore the amount of money that has to be allocated to buying back shares has to increase commensurately in order to have the same punch. And that hasn't been the case over the last year, because prices have gone up so much. So then if we have a situation where not only is our share buybacks not keeping pace with the with how prices have moved, but are in fact no longer rising themselves, then that removes a substantial tailwind from the stock market. And that too is contributing to the kind of corrective phase that we have right now. But against that background, it is worth considering that valuations are improving, and improving rapidly. And there's a number of companies in the banking sector are on single-digit multiples right now. And you look at, for example, Apple, where you know it's got a PE of 10 and it's yielding 2 and a bit. Or Kimberly-Clark, where you've got a yield of 2 or 3%. Some people are looking at those types of companies, types of companies that have got long records of increasing their dividends, and where valuations are beginning to improve. And generally speaking, the dividend aristocrats have not pulled back in the same fashion as the wider market, and not least because they have safe haven characteristics. The other asset class that has had an extreme move this week is gold. And gold was up $50 yesterday. It maybe not finished up $50, but at one point during the day, it was up $50. And a 5% move in gold like that is a big move, and particularly when we had a relatively inert environment that predominated for the last 7 or 8 months. Well, gold right now is rallying on fear. And there have been stories about the physical inventory at COMEX has been run down, that People no longer want to allow their gold to be lent out. And these types of eventualities are certainly contributing to additional interest in gold. The fact that gold has now broken what has been a lengthy progression of lower rally highs suggests that we've seen not just a short-term low, but a medium-term low. And yes, it is overbought in the short term, and that's what we expect, that something that has been going down for such a long time, that the rally, when it gets going and the short covering starts, takes people by surprise. And it's certainly taken people by surprise. And really, a sustained move below the 200-day moving average would be required to really question gold's recovery potential. And it was down a little bit in here today, but it would be natural for some consolidation after such a very large move. And the last 5 years have been particularly painful for gold miners, where gold prices were declining and their marginal costs of production had increased because they'd spent so much money on developing new mines. And of course, the high price of oil had an additional bearing on that. Well, expansion plans have been cancelled. Marginal supply has left the market. And for the first time in almost a decade, gold miners are now offering a high beta play on gold. They weren't able to do that when they were loading up on debt. And really, gold outperformed the mining sector very impressively for much of the bull market up to the 2011 high. And that situation has now changed because a lot of these gold mines have gone through incredibly painful processes of rationalization. And a lot of the additional staff in headquarters have been fired, and they're running much slimmer operations. So the Gold Bugs Index is rallying, and I've posted a number of shares today for the South Africa, US listed South African mines, and they're all now rallying really rather impressively. And gold, when redenominated into Rand, rallied this week to new all-time highs and to test the 20,000 Rand area. And that'll tell you just how much the Rand has deteriorated and how much gold has rallied. And, often what we've said over the last decade and more is that gold does best when it's rallying against all currencies. And if it's a monetary metal, then it does best when it's rallying against other currencies. And it's been rallying against just about everything except the US dollar. And this week we saw it starting to break out against the US dollar. So right now, at a time when people really are afraid, then gold has been the currency of choice. And it is perhaps the best performing currency so far this year. Then if we start to put some of this in perspective, there is another thing that is probably worth talking about, and it is the role of ETFs, because everybody owns ETFs now. And this move into passive investing and the ease with which people can do it means that and the way that the ETF industry launches funds. They launch a plethora of funds in the hope that one will become popular, and then that fund would signify the market. And with deleveraging, then people sell indiscriminately. And when they have a profit in something like biotech, then it all comes out at the same time. So, very interesting, for example, that the biotech sector has sold off very aggressively, not least because it had that Nasdaq Biotech ETF where there was billions invested. And medical devices, which is a reasonably well-related sector, has hardly moved at all. And one of the reasons it has hardly moved is because it didn't experience the leveraged bullish interest previously. But more importantly, there's no ETF. There's no ETF for medical devices. And if there's no ETF for medical devices, it's not that easy a sector to invest in, which means that people do not have big leverage positions that now need to be unwound. So we can see very clearly, just within those two sectors, that in a sector where there was large leverage positions, that has contributed to the speed of the decline. And if people are panicky sellers, then it's probably not a bad time to start thinking about looking for relative strength and looking for the kinds of things that people sold in a panic but are now rushing to buy back. That's why we look for relative strength after a big pullback. So, yes, this is a corrective phase. And yes, the volatility that we've seen in markets, it has been extreme. But there is no corrective phase that doesn't bring out buying opportunities. And then there's a couple of other things that probably need to consider. And one of those is China. China has been closed all this week because of the New Year holiday. And Hong Kong opened up again on Thursday, and it has been down, I think, 2.5 to 3% both days. So we can expect China to open down about 4 or 5% on Monday. And anything better than that would probably be considered to be really quite a positive outcome. And in the event that China goes up on Monday, well, then that could be seen and that would be taken as an opportunity to put on some risk-on trades, because this week has been all about risk-off. We've seen a little bit of steadying here on a Friday afternoon, and then people will be looking for what happens in China on Monday. Then looking around at every stock market, it's probably worth considering, is there any that is not pulling back violently? Because we've looked at Europe, and you look at the US, and you look at a number of sectors, and you look at Japan, and China's been underperforming for a long time. And so what's not pulling back violently? And there's a couple. It's a small number. One of them is Indonesia. They had their currency devaluation a year ago. The central bank has stepped in and said their number one priority is supporting the currency. And the stock market has turned has now got a higher reaction low and put on a higher high this week. So that's potentially interesting. It's also interesting that in Singapore, where the banking sector has been weak, that Jardine Matheson and Jardine Strategic and Jardine Cycling Carriage, all of which have got fairly substantial Indonesian holdings, are holding up quite a bit better than the wider market. And those are very large holding companies for the ASEAN region generally. Then looking in Latin America, where places like Brazil and Venezuela are making headlines because they're in so much trouble. And yet Colombia, the Colombian stock market, has been really fairly steady. So yes, there is a lot to worry about, and there have been extraordinary moves, but not everywhere. It really isn't everywhere, and then we got to ask why. So then when we see relative strength like that, then it's something that is probably worth keeping an eye on, because we could be getting very early clues as to what's the thing that's going to lead us out of this corrective phase. And then if we look at this medium to long term, then what we've seen is, for example, on Wall Street, the market ranged for 12 years and experienced an explosive breakout. And this is the first big consolidation in that new secular bull market. And we can't say yet that that secular or that medium term correction is over. But we're nowhere near questioning that this is a new secular bull market, and that this is really only a process of valuation contraction following an 18-month period where valuations did expand because earnings were not rising in at the same pace. And when you look at the Europe stocks 600 index, then it's been ranging for 16 years. And it had got right up to test the upper side of its range and has pulled back violently. And what it really needs to do is to find support above the 2009 lows and to rally impressively, to really demonstrate that things are improving here. And the FTSE 100 is in a very similar situation. And because there are so many resources and energy shares on that index, then they've had a heavy influence on the index's performance. Then we're not out of this corrective phase. I feel like I'm repeating myself, so I apologize. But we know what it will look like when we are, because the overextensions will get unwound. Then indices will close their overextensions relative to their trend means. They'll find support at a higher level when they pull back again, and then they'll push back above their 200-day moving averages. And then we'll know. We'll have great evidence. Right now, we're limited to conjecture because we just don't have the evidence. And I guess throughout this entire audio, what I've talked about is very large overextensions. And the one index that is not overextended right now is the VIX. The VIX is hovering below the 30 area. And, you know, the VIX is a great index. When you're looking for something to give you an indication that, you know, people have capitulated and, you know, and that we might be close to a low, but the VIX has not spiked higher. And if the VIX were at 50, well, then we have a much better indication that we've had a really aggressive selling period and that it was time to be getting back in. But that has not yet happened. And that's probably something that people are watching. They're probably waiting for the VIX to have that big blowout sell off so that then they can reestablish their long positions. So could we have an additional period of volatility? Yes, it's absolutely possible. And have the rallies that we saw in here today been enough to really pressure the shorts in stocks? Probably not. But yes, we have these oversold conditions. And then we're likely in the short term to get an additional bounce from these levels. So that's the short term. The medium term is that this is still a corrective phase. And longer term, then we look at the pace of technological innovation and look at the rise of the global middle class, and then look at the way that energy prices have contracted and are unlikely to get back to the levels that we were at just a year ago. And those are the kinds of things that can really stimulate a major bull market. And it really is all down to governance. And right now the USA is doing better than everyone else because it took big substantive steps to write down debt, to reinvigorate the banking sector, and to stimulate the economy. It did it early, and it did it with a very firm commitment. So the USA is coming out of this corrective phase better than everywhere else. Then Europe has got these political problems, and Japan has an issue with its ability to push through the kind of fiscal reforms that are really required. And the last point that I'd like to finish on is something about China, because China needs a weaker currency. And then it's probably worth considering that every other currency in the world has had some period of weakness over the last few years, whereas the renminbi has been the one currency that has not pulled back with everything else. Then it's not to say that if the Chinese decide to devalue their currency further, which looks to be practically inevitable at this stage, that it's going to have a massively disruptive effect, because it's devaluing its currency against currencies that have already been devalued. This isn't the kind of environment which we had during the Asian financial crisis in the 90s, because those currencies were all very strong at the time. And that is simply not the case right now. And you know, then yes, China absolutely needs a weaker currency. Their manufacturing sector, and I've seen this firsthand and talked to people that run factories and ask them how is business, and the one thing that they all say, and they've been saying it for years, is that the currency is too strong. They've had to deal with higher commodity prices. They obviously don't have that problem anymore, but higher wages have not gone away, and then they lost their export markets. They had been doing a roaring trade in the US, and then you had the credit crisis. Then you had the sovereign wealth crisis in Europe. Now you have the commodity markets deteriorating, and the Middle East. So a lot of the export markets that China had previously relied on have dried up. And against that background, then what is the rationale for them to have such a firm currency? Then they need a weaker currency, and they're going to get one. But how much of a disruptive influence that's likely to have, I rather question. I think a lot of people are of the opinion that it's going to be massively disruptive, and that would only be the case, if people were competing directly with Chinese manufacturing, and that's certainly not the case for places like North America or Europe. It's probably a bigger problem for its hinterland, but a number of countries that compete with China in manufacturing have much lower costs, and a lot of the manufacturing that's already left China is unlikely to come back. This is an enormously fluid environment, but we're already well into this corrective phase, and no, it's not over, but we know what it's going to look like when it is over. And central banks have got an awful lot of tools at their disposal, and it would be very rash to question their resolve, and not least because central bankers will do whatever it is they can to preserve their own jobs, and that means doing the very best that they can. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.